You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. We start today in Marin, where the outbreak of COVID-19 at San Quentin State Prison has surpassed 1,000 positive cases, including more than 100 prison workers who tested positive. The outbreak is especially personal for us here at Cross Currents because we teach and work with men there as part of a program funded by the state prisons. The outbreak happened after a transfer of prisoners from Chino. And as the state manages this crisis, people in the criminal justice field have been sounding the alarm about possible prison breakouts since April, like Hadar Aviram. She's a law professor at UC Hastings specializing in criminal justice, and she's been following the COVID outbreak in prison closely. I called her up and first asked her about a letter she wrote to Governor Gavin Newsom nearly 3 months ago. Back in April, you wrote to Governor Newsom sounding the alarm about what could happen if COVID hit the prison system, especially in regards to what you called the appalling health conditions in prisons. The Supreme Court called it that, actually. As you see the news today, I mean, you must feel like I was trying to tell you guys. What were you worried about at the time? And is what's happening now what you predicted?
We are witnessing what can only be described as a human rights disaster in California prisons. And there is nothing about this disaster that was not foreseeable. California prisons have unique vulnerabilities, which is why we are seeing this virus now ravaging California prisons. We're hearing about the tragedies in San Quentin, but it's not the only ones. We're seeing this across the prison system. There is nothing here that was unexpected, and my colleagues and I had pointed this out numerous times. Specifically with regard to California, we have a very unique history with regard to prison healthcare and the ways that we've tried to alleviate that over the years that have made our prisons uniquely vulnerable to this kind of risk. I think a good way to think about this is to look at this through sort of a triggers and vulnerabilities perspective. That the trigger, of course, is the pandemic and multiple things that have happened, you know, in terms of mismanaging things and botched transfers between prisons. But all of this is coming against the backdrop of already deep-seated vulnerabilities, healthcare deficiencies, the way we house and populate our prisons, the way we calculate overcrowding, all of these things coming together to create a perfect storm and to put lives at risk.
As of Tuesday, 1,080 prisoners have tested positive for COVID-19 at San Quentin, as well as 102 employees. That's double the number from the previous week. Last month, there were zero. Can you tell us about that botched transfer that you were talking about from Chino? What happened?
Sure. So as far as we know, the botched transfer consisted of people being moved from the California Institute of Men, which is in Chino, which was seeing a huge outbreak and still is actually grappling with big numbers of people who are still sick there and were not tested, or were tested back where they were still in Chino and not tested or quarantined upon arrival to San Quentin. And this is one of the risks, of course. We're now seeing, if I'm looking at the picture of what prisons look like overall, there are prisons that have not been infected by the pandemic. But of course, the minute you introduce people from the outside, be it staff, be it inmates, people that are not tested or quarantined, you run the risk that things are going to run amok. Now, what's especially interesting about San Quentin is that we're seeing the virus spread very quickly, not just among general population, but even on death row. And keep in mind that on death row in Quentin, people are housed in single cells. So if the virus is infecting people there and ravaging people, you know, think about how little social distancing you can do everywhere else in the prison where people are not doing time in single cells. The combination of the botched transfer and the already, you know, problematic setup of the prison that doesn't really allow any social distancing to speak of.
Mm. And San Quentin had its first death row death from COVID as well. Can you talk about the CDCR tracker that you did a deep dive into? So CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, They have a COVID tracking tool. How reliable is their tracking and what are you learning from it?
I actually want to really commend CDCR for the tracking tool because it's excellent. They don't only track infections, they track how many people are still in custody, how many released, how many have recovered. Mostly for the prisoners, they also have a separate page for the staff. And they're also tracking very carefully their percentage of testing. One only wishes that the way they address the actual pandemic was as competent as the way that they're tracking it on the tracker. And the tracker gives us a perspective not only on what's going on at this moment, just kind of like a snapshot of what's happening in prisons, but also over time, how this disease is migrating from prison to prison. The other amazing thing about having this information is that it allows us to take this information and cross it with what we know about the surrounding counties. And this is really crucial to understand. A lot of the commentary that I'm seeing about what's happening in prisons now are looking at prisons as if they're separate from the community. Prisons are not separate from the community. They are part of the community by virtue of staff coming in and out of prisons. And by doing an analysis comparing the data from the LA Times about county infections, I'm noticing that when there are spikes in a particular prison, you see very shortly after, again, I can't tell you an airtight causal story because we don't have contact tracing, but very shortly after, you see spikes in the surrounding county. And this is not a big surprise, right? The staff will leave. You know, they shop on the way home. They eat on the way home. You know, of course, whatever happens in prisons is also going to impact the surrounding community.
Hmm. You've been following COVID in prisons. You've put kind of the prisons in categories according to their situation. For example, one category is the outbreak came and gone, or outbreak ongoing and unabated, or recent outbreak, or handful of cases, or no cases. Can you talk about the cases where the outbreak is ongoing and unabated, and then the recent outbreak? Because it includes, you know, San Quentin, but it also includes other places and other areas.
Sure. I think that one of the problems that we have trying to figure out what's going on is that there is a lot that happens that we would not be aware of unless newspapers or news outlets broke the story. So, for example, we can only understand what happened in San Quentin because we know about the botched transfer from Chino. Similarly, we can only understand what is happening in Susanville right now, which is also crazy and also dealing with hundreds of cases because there was, in turn, a botched transfer from Quentin once there was an infection there to the prisons in Susanville. So these kind of, these little, you know, when we learn about these kinds of events, they explain a lot about what happened. What is really hard to understand is why in some places there have been lots of cases. I'm thinking about Avenal State Prison and some other places, and they've seen hundreds of cases and then gradually the infection rate dies down versus places that are still struggling with numbers of cases not abating and continuing to see new cases again and again, even though it's been weeks since the first cases were seen. And it remains to be seen whether we're going to see the same dynamic coming up in the places that have newer bouts of outbreaks, such as San Quentin and CCC. So those are really complicated to understand. And it's hard to put them in context without the surrounding events.
Sure. We've seen inmates have been moved to triage tents outside. What other things have been happening inside the prisons in terms of just precautions, health precautions, and regulations put in place to prevent the spread?
Well, certainly not enough. This is one thing that we know. We know that there are severe shortages in sanitation gear. We know that in some places it's hard to get access to masks. Very recently, prisons have asked volunteer organizations to give them masks because they can't cope with the demand. The fact that we're now 3 months into this and the California Department of Corrections doesn't have enough masks for the prisoners is I think, really shocking, a shocking disregard for human life. We're seeing efforts to social distance, but here's the important point, and this is something I was alluding to earlier, which is that just 10 years ago, we had extensive litigation against the state trying to reduce the population in prisons because at the time, we were housing almost twice as many people in California prisons as the prisons could actually contain. So we have managed to reduce considerably the number of people in prisons, but it's not even across prisons. So there still are places that are very, very overcrowded. And I say this precisely because some of those places are places where when I look at the tracker, I see a very small number of cases. So when I look, for example, at a place like High Desert State Prison, and I see that they have, as of this morning, they had 4 cases, right? I'm looking at it and I'm saying to myself, well, they've only tested 11% of their inmates, so we don't actually know what's going on. And I know that that prison is at 154% capacity. So even if they want to socially distance people, where are they going to put them? So we're seeing efforts at Quentin, for example, to, you know, to move into the yard, to put out tents, to try and, you know, get just more territory, just more a bigger area to put people in. But as we're moving into summer and some of these places become unbearably hot, putting people outside in tents, especially sick people with no air conditioning, is really, really unthinkable.
So CDCR has tested more than a third of their inmates. Why is the testing so minimal? Are people refusing to get tested? What's going on?
So if we look carefully institution by institution, we can see that the testing rates actually vary very dramatically between institutions. So in some places, they've tested almost the entire population, right? At Avenal, for example, they're at something like 97%. At other prisons, they've only tested 10 or 11%. So there's big variation. And my suspicion is that the testing comes reactively. It comes after they already learn of cases, and then they rush to test everybody to find out what's going on, which is why I think that a lot of the places where we're not yet seeing outbreaks might be the next epicenter, but we're not going to catch it in time because the testing percentage there is so low. So I think that might have that's partly the problem, that the testing seems to be more reactive than proactive.
Hadar, there's a question that I think is at the core of this about human value and who matters and who doesn't. Do you think that question is relevant here?
I think it's important to address the question because I think that a lot of people are secretly or maybe not so secretly wondering about this exact same thing. I think the most interesting place where I've experienced people asking this question, you know, quietly or not so quietly, is in the context of death row inmates, where I sometimes hear people or see people on social media saying, well, you know, these people were sentenced to die anyway. The problem with thinking that is that we have a lot of myths about people in prison. We think a lot of things about them. We think that they're dangerous people. We think that the death penalty was uniquely crafted for just the worst of the worst, and that's the only people that are on death row. All of these things, I'm sorry to say, there is robust empirical evidence to say that they are not true. We know that whether somebody gets sentenced to death or to life without parole is really arbitrary. It's not that we've captured the worst of the worst. And I will say something else. Right now, we have a moratorium on the death penalty in California. But before that, and actually even now, because the death penalty is still on the books, we've spent decades litigating to the tune of billions of dollars over whether we kill somebody with one drug or 3 drugs or this drug or that drug. So what do all these technicalities mean if when the time to protect people comes, we're letting people be sentenced via COVID? Right. So there's this question that I want to ask. I think that the real question is to the governor. The governor very courageously and very bravely put a moratorium on the death penalty. Is this what he wanted to see? A moratorium and then for people to be sentenced to die via a virus that they couldn't foresee and that they weren't sentenced to experience? We're also imposing not only on people in prison, we're imposing on their families. We're putting a lot of pressure on staff in prisons. So there are a lot of aspects of this that go to the core of the question of what is the value of a human life. And for anybody who is still secretly harboring some thoughts about some people being worth less than others, perhaps, I want to remind you again that prisons are not separate from the community. And everywhere where we've seen spikes in prisons, we consequently just a few days later see spikes in the neighboring community. What we're now seeing in Lassen County is a classic example of that, right? As soon as the case numbers rise in Lassen, we're seeing rises in Lassen County. Lassen County legislature actually writes to the secretary of CDCR, this is as of 2 days ago, saying, what's going on? You're endangering people in my county. And now the prisons and the community have to work together to deal with this. And finally, it's going to dawn on us that prisoners are actually part of the community to which they belong.
Mm. We started this interview with your letter from back in April warning about all of this. If you were writing a letter today, what would you say to Governor Newsom? What needs to happen now?
So I am getting lots of emails from Governor Newsom and communications in which he's addressing his fellow Californians. And he's saying to us, do your part, wear your mask, you know, socially distance, stay at home, do your part to prevent the spread. What I would like to say to the governor now is it's not important who's to blame. It's important what's going to happen now. It's triage time. Do your part. Let people go home out of public health considerations, not out of the optics of what it looks like. A quarter of the California prison population is people who are aged 50 and up. These people have spent decades in prison. They are old. They are sick. The risk that they pose to public safety is zero, regardless of what they were sentenced for, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. These people belong at home. Ramp up the testing. Find out what's going on. For heaven's sake, no more transfers to places that don't have cases. This only ends in tragedy. All of this effort, all of this sacrifice that everybody who is listening to us is putting in, wearing masks, distancing yourselves, you know, taking care of your kids without childcare, all of this enormous effort that everybody's doing for 3 months, this is completely worthless if we're incubating this disease in dozens of places in our communities.
And do you think that's likely to happen?
I very much hope so. I really hope that the publicity now is moving the needle. I'm very frustrated that when the time was to make, you know, well-organized decisions about this, which is 3 months ago when we were all writing and warning about this, we didn't get any traction. It's very hard to get traction these days if you're right too early. But we were right then and we're right now. And there are still things that we can do now that can save lives. And I implore anybody with the power to do something to do them right now.
Okay. Hadar Aviram, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Hadar Aviram, a law professor at UC Hastings, specializing in criminal justice.